This is episode 28 with Nick Jenkel and Dr. David Griffith.
Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue.
Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Podcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. We're here in episode 28. You know, they say that most podcasts don't make it past episode 7, so I'm really happy to be doing this season 2, continually growing this future intelligence leadership concept and podcast. We've had some amazing guests on the first 27 episodes. If you haven't listened to those, please go back and check them out. And today I'm excited to welcome Nick Jenkel and Dr. David Griffith. Nick is a professional keynote speaker and transformation catalyst. He is a co-founder of two enterprises, Switch On and Future Makers. Nick co-founded his first company at age 24 and grew it exponentially to be a world leader in breakthrough innovation. After a personal breakthrough in his understanding of purpose at age 30, he pivoted to develop regenerative innovation approaches and biotransformation theory and practice, which is a rigorous pathway for mastering transformation in any human endeavor that fuses latest brain and complexity science with profound contemplative wisdom. Dr. David Griffith is a PhD, but not an academic. He's trusted by executives in some of the world's best-known brands. He harnesses the power of science to create impact and meaningful value for change leaders and managers. David shows leaders and managers how to move knowledge to action to create meaningful value for themselves, their teams, their organizations, and wider society. David has worked with some of the world's best-known brands in 17 countries to help leaders and managers accelerate change and transformation. In this episode, we tackle the contrast between big thinking and practical application. So if you're interested in the importance of cognitive and emotional complexity, why leaders need to allow a space for meaning to inspire meaningful action and meaningful value, how micro-interventions for expanding leadership capability and capacity needs to be supported by embodiment, what happens when leaders ask the wrong questions, why there is not a one-size-fit-all to learning and development, Ashby's Law of Variety and how that impacts diversity and inclusion, how leaders can get people to swarm around the future vision, why many leaders are doing the wrong things brilliantly, why the future is like building a plane while you fly, and why leaders need to give themselves permission to move from being a cook to a chef, then this episode is for you. Let's listen. So aloha, David and Nick, thank you both for joining me today on this episode of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Podcast. And as always, I want to start with this key question of how can leadership be more intelligent or smart about the future, given this climate of complexity, uncertainty, exponential change? And I'd like you both to answer it from your own perspectives. And I'll start with Nick.
Okay, big question. I'll try and keep it a short answer. So I think we all agree that the level of complexity is beyond that which any human community has ever had to deal with. And most leaders have to interface with that complexity, even if they're in a tiny micro business, right up to a multinational or government or supranational government. And in my view, intelligent leadership is a composite of actually two different capacities that are kind of artificially separated, but useful to separate so that we can understand them, distinguish them. The first is what I would call cognitive behavioral complexity, which summary is we call it insightful action, which is the capacity to solve ever more complex problems and execute the solution effectively. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of more traditional understanding of intelligence and IQ and levels of engagement with different levels of or stages of complexity. But then my belief from my own experience working with leaders, but also being a leader, is that it's no longer enough to be smart. And in fact, smarts can often be get in the way of what needs to actually occur. And so we also look at another dimension, which we think of as a horizontal dimension of complexity, of development, of evolution, which you could call interoceptive affective complexity or emotional felt sense complexity, which could be summarized as embodied wisdom, which would be about being able to take care of ever more expansive problems away from our core self, so family, friends, society, planet, and tend to the suffering with presence, with relational power, with humility, vulnerability, etc. So put together, if you are developing your smarts, your insightful action, and your embodied wisdom, your wisdom, then you can solve ever more complex problems with transformational solutions, and most importantly, bring people along with you for the journey, which when you get to a certain level of complexity, so looking at systems problems, they can't be solved by one genius, no matter how brilliant they are.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, Nick.
So from my perspective, you know, we talk, complexity's become a bit of a buzzword for the last 10, 15 years. Complexity's always existed, and it's relative. It's our ability to deal with complexity. There is no one single form of complexity. It's a wide overarching body of science and evidence, theories, etc. We can't even get to total agreement on what complexity means at times. I do subscribe, we were talking about Dave Snowden and the Kinevin framework, I do subscribe to that notion that actually leadership takes place in four key domains and we create a fifth. I like Dave's work around simple, complicated, complex, and chaotic, and that we create disorder when we don't really understand how we should be acting, how we should make sense of the world according to the domain that we're actually in. So complexity is only one aspect of leadership. The other side for me is that our ability to negotiate complexity, that ability to function as a leader in complexity, it's about dealing with uncertainty, and people have a different load tolerance of dealing with uncertainty. And so for me, leadership is about creating an anticipated future. And it's about being able to understand changes in the environment. We're actually change leaders. And it's understanding changes in the environment. It's being able to anticipate changes in the environment or respond to changes in the environment. It's about reducing people's uncertainty by exposing as many of the unknowns as possible to us. We can get into that lovely Rumsfeld conundrum, which I know he was lambasted for with that whole known unknowns, unknown knowns, unknown knowns. But really, it is about trying to reduce the unknowns, reducing uncertainty, reduce uncertainty, we reduce fear. And for me, a lot of what we do in helping leaders is ensuring that we establish meaning, and by establishing meaning we can move to meaningful action. In establishing meaningful action, we can create meaningful value. And that there's a lot of work that's been going on around servant leadership at the moment, but really, if we learn lessons, if you like, from non-traditional sources like the FBI Stairway to Behavioral Change and crisis intervention, when we distill things down, we get to a point of great leaders dealing with complexity and bringing meaning and giving people the understanding that they're, that feeling that their needs are being met. It starts from a position of powerful questions, active listening, being able to develop empathy to the point where the people that they are working with, that are working with them, that are swarming around them, all right, and them as part of the swarm can turn around and go, when they describe the world through their eyes, they can go, that's right. When we get to that point, we can establish common ground and establish rapport around our beliefs, attitudes, skills, knowledge, experience, and talent. And at that point, we're granted as leaders the permissions to give, to have influence. And when we create, have enough influence, we reach that tipping point where we can get to meaningful behavioral change. And that's kind of where I come from.
Really great, you know, answers. And what I'm interested in hearing, just for the audience, is what are some kind of practical now ways to understand what we just talked about there? And Nick, would like to start with you. What are some, you know, what are some tools or methods or just some real tangible ways to think about this question?
Well, the methods are long and practices are many. So I can talk about some ways to approach practices, I guess, in a moment. Yeah. And just responding to David's thought that I hear in what he's saying a similar approach to mine. I work in what I call transformational leadership. So it's how do you transform self, organization, system. And it is a marriage of this sort of cognitive processing of understanding the kind of domain you're in and the kind of solutions that domain requires, simple, complicated, complex, et cetera. And then it's married to this realization that it's actually all about people as well, and about relationships, about listening, empathy, hearing, mirroring back. That's a great tool. Slowing everything down. So you, even if you think you know what someone's saying, you mirror it back to them. So their nervous system can relax and they can join you in presence. And that's often a bigger win than actually the content of what the conversation was about. Mm-hmm. It's the relational field growing in strength. And one of the things that I'm very aware of, so before I worked in leadership, I ran an innovation consultancy for many years. And when you're doing innovation, people think it's separate from leadership, like it's a whole little domain of its own. All innovation, all adaptation, all change, all transformation is a function of trust. It's the lubricant that allows that, because it reduces fear, increases safety, increases togetherness, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always this marriage going on of I need to understand how, what the future is happening. I need to understand trends. I need to understand, be aware of different markets. So I'm always keeping. So another practice I have is I keep reaching out into markets that I'm not aware of or not working in at the moment. And I keep connecting with people that I just have a sense there's a resonance or there's an intuitive something. I don't even know what it is. And then I have a real world or virtual coffee with them every year or every 2 years, or every 5 years if we drop out. And often those connections, these weak links, weak signals bring in information that's different to my core field. And that's super useful. Things like Clubhouse, I've just started getting into listening in to random talks that someone in my group is talking about. Just keeping yourself plugged into all these different things. So that's kind of like the cognitive piece, proactively engaging with this future. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this interoceptive internal piece, which is really about studying your own inner responses to these things. What triggers fear? What triggers curiosity? What triggers empathy? What do you try and avoid because it's too much or too uncertain or too complex? And definitely agreeing with David that one of the tools of a leader, and there's actually a great quote from Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, on this, which is, you know, we should be using our intelligence to tell better stories that create better meaning frames and simpler metaphors for people to understand who don't want to or have the capacity to engage in this complexity at the level that the leader might be, and to shape and shield them from a lot of the noise which they shouldn't have to or don't want to get involved in, and shape that sort of meaning framework so it's focused, so their work is focused on the right part without disempowering people and dumbing stuff down and being disenfranchising people from their own innate intelligence, which is usually much higher than they often and their manager imagines they have.
That one is engaging people, especially in different markets and different ways of thinking, and staying connected to them to get those signals, that cognitive signals information. Yeah. And then the second one is really learning, I'd say, like your emotional trigger or response to many things in life, but could be also to those trigger, those trends as well.
Even pre-emotional. So there's a lot of work at the moment in what's called interoceptive awareness and understanding that emotions are actually a combination of our meaning frames mixed with physiological states like hunger, exhaustion, uncertainty, you know, sense of not knowing something. And so basically what you're talking about is outside-in practices, which are bringing the crazy outside world into me as a leader in my little provincial area. And we're all provincial to some degree. And then there's inside out practices, which are, who am I in this moment in my body, not anyone else's, because that's the only body I'm ever going to get. And as far as you know, and then how those two meet together, which is when sense making and decision making occur.
Mm, great. And David, follow up on that, some thoughts.
So I'm going to go back to practical.
Yeah.
So I deal a lot with change, transformation, and leaders, and we can have the debate on difference between change and transformation. And if we get to transformation, we've actually missed the change. What I would say is that when I work in, let's go with an energy company, okay, with a leadership team that is trying to create change across 4 geographic locations, and they bring the heads of their business unit in together. And the resistance to the change initiative is one of, I don't have time. Mm. Without fail, in any organization I've worked with, 17 different countries now, the default position is one of judgment over curiosity. The default position becomes one of sales versus over and persuasion over curiosity. So the leadership default position, the reflex response becomes, I don't have time, is just an excuse. And so to overcome that excuse, I'm going to tell you how great this change initiative is. I'm going to tell you how easy this change initiative is going to be for you and what great benefits you're going to get from it. I am going to show you. And at the end of it, you're going to come to my way of thinking. And then people go away and they're still resisting the change. I still don't have time and I'm still not interested. And the reason being is that we're not really interested. This leadership team goes away. They sit in a bubble. They haven't engaged and involved people. They then come out and tell people that they know all about them, but they don't get the, that's right. They haven't developed the empathy and the rapport. They haven't been given the permissions for the influence. So we go to things like that, back to those types of positions, and we do something very practical. So instead of responding with the reflex response of, I'm going to persuade you, the response could be instead asking a more powerful question, which is, what would bring you to have more time for this initiative? And a lot of what we do are small, minor adjustments, practical adjustments to the way that leaders actually ask questions. A great example is, so if anybody's listening to this podcast at the moment, watching it, okay, hopefully we're giving you a lot to think about, all right? You're experiencing a bit of cognitive drain, you go through ego depletion, your brain's getting tired, hopefully, all right? You've come out of this podcast and you've got about a 10-minute gap before you go into another important meeting, all right, that's going to require a lot of your energy. You're presenting. Somebody catches you in that 10 minutes and they say, how was the podcast? You're going to go to an automatic response, all right? Your brain's acting to help you. It's conserving energy. It's a poor question, so I'm going to get away with this. Yeah. Fine, good, rubbish. Don't listen to Dave, okay? And when we ask poor questions like that, we get poor responses. But if you ask a better question, such as, what was the one thing that you took away from the podcast that could have an impact on our team? I can't say good. I've got to engage. I've got to move from a system one automatic response to a system two response. And that's the type of thing that leaders can take away from this type of podcast in terms of practical changes in asking powerful questions that allow you to build empathy, meaning, to create meaningful actions.
I would agree to a large part in that there are many micro interventions that can be used. There's question-based solution versus problem-focused questionings, appreciative inquiry type things. There's count, stop and count to 10 seconds. There's ask three things. And everyone always wants the hack, right? Because that's part of the reflex of leadership when you're busy is, well, what's the one thing? What's the three things? What's the seven things? What's the nine things? And I definitely believe, you know, sentence stem interventions where you start a sentence and everyone has to finish it. These kind of things are really powerful. The challenge I think we've got is that if that's where we leave people as leaders, we are not developing their own capacity to sense into this moment with their tools and sentence stems and micro interventions and be appropriate in the moment, the right mindset, the right approach, because the moment's never going to be like that again. And there's going to be, and if you're constantly giving people the answer, they're not, we'll never catch up because there's never going to be another moment like that again, because by the time they have us for another keynote or another program, the world's moved on. So I believe it's a both and thing. You've got micro interventions, you've got tangible things, you've got, we've got scripts for conflict mediation, you know, all these kind of really micro, you know, how to build a new habit. Here's three ways to do it, blah, 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 blah. And I also believe that part of this embodied wisdom piece is about developing people's capacity to rely on their own innate wisdom and intelligence to self-solve in the moment with some principles, with some understanding of how their brain works, with some understanding of how their body works, not just their brain, so that they are also learning the principles underneath the micro interventions and are raising their consciousness to a point where the micro interventions are almost like the scaffolding and they helped you get to the house, but then you can take the scaffolding away because you now have a deeper understanding of human to human and human to machine, whatever, industry relationships. So I think there's always, I'm not sure all leaders want to do that because it takes a lot more engagement. It takes a lot more deep learning rather than sort of surface learning. And if we go too much into the academic term, which is the death sentence of a leadership program, is, oh, it's very academic. It's like, well, you know, you've got some brain networks. You might want to know what they do. Too much academic, no good. But too much solution oriented. And I think people lose their own capacities to grow, which helps them not just in their work. It helps them in, you know, life. Yeah.
You'll have to forgive me, Nick, because I think that the question was about a practical intervention, something that people could take away. So that's my response to a practical intervention.
Absolutely.
And I think that with what you're talking about, you're absolutely correct. But the notion that everybody can achieve this embodied wisdom to get to this point of ultimate awareness, whatever we want to term it these days, what I would say to you is that ultimately that it's based on their limitations, that the idea that anybody can be anything they want to be, unfortunately, we know that people are constrained not by total resource, but by their limiting resource. We can talk about the constraints of field independence versus field dependence, the constraints that are brought on by locus of control. What I think that we have to be interested in is helping leaders to provide, to find practical interventions that, going away from conversations like this, we can have deep intellectual banter. But ultimately, it doesn't help leaders in the workplace today to bring about an effective change in a meeting that they are going to go into. And I think that that has to be, for me, that's the focus of the work I do, is really about the applied side of this. That's what I say in response to that. And that's not to say that Nick is incorrect. I really appreciate a lot of the things that he's talking about, but I struggle because Nick has also made a very good point about the academic side. So I do a lot of work in adult, you know, my background is adult learning, knowledge management, systems, complexity. We can have some very, very deep discussions, but unfortunately, they are not necessarily meaningful to the audience that are watching or listening to this type of podcast. If it's not meaningful, then ultimately, we create more uncertainty. We create more uncertainty. The use of language, even, as Nick rightly pointed out, it erodes trust, all right? Erodes trust, people aren't going to listen to us, and ultimately, we get people pushing away from a lot of the concepts that we're trying to introduce. And I think that that's more my default position.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because in the foresight space is something I introduced to several years ago. And it, what I realized about it was that it tended to be a little more academic, you know, than practical. And even in the trainings I've done in it, it tends to be a little more academic, and it also tends to be very, it's these very long, drawn out processes, you know, that's not going to necessarily help, you know, a leader who needs to make some decisions right now, right? Or a leadership team who needs, you know, who has a very short time frame of decision making. And you know, working with a team at Rolls-Royce, and one of the things that we did is we integrated a lot of, I think, what you're talking about, both of you are talking about, where we did do some practices that helped them to get more present and embodied in their knowledge, and then in their storytelling and in their, in the future even. But we didn't tell them we were doing that either, right? We kept it, you know, we just integrated into the process, so we didn't get the any pushback, right? But by the end, what we noticed, well, one of the things we did notice is that they, it wasn't just a cognitive buy-in, right? Or into the futures they were creating. It was a more like, we're going to really do this kind of feeling. And when they came out of it, they actually implemented faster than they've ever implemented something before as a team. And that was really interesting to see.
That was a foresight intervention rather than a leadership program.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was more foresight, but we had to do, I think, like some of the stuff that Nick was talking about is essential in there in order to get to the place where they were willing to take the actions, right? And not just have another meeting about what they thought was a good idea, right? So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. How do we create these interventions, you know, that allow them to really, you know, integrate what Nick's talking about, you know, but also get the practical action?
But I think you've just hit the nail on the head. So I did my, it was my birthday yesterday. So I did my birthday webinar and we talked about the difference between a good idea and a meaningful idea. So we've got all these good ideas, but how do they create meaning that leans to meaningful action that creates meaningful value? You know, and I think that that is the challenge, and that becomes very, it's very situative. It is context specific. It's understanding what a given leader or leadership team is sensing at that moment and getting them to understand that what they're sensing at the moment has already changed. Momentum has already taken things on. You know, we can learn things from quantum mechanics in terms of what you believe to be true is based on historical data, that data, the momentum has already happened. What you're now going to do is disturb that momentum. We don't actually know what the future was going to be. You have anticipated, you know, that idea of anticipatory awareness and foresight. You are anticipating a future, but you are one agent, all right, in a leadership team. So the leader is one agent in a leadership team where you are, that anticipated future is one version. Yeah. Well, you are now going to get competing and collaborating versions of, against that anticipated future. How do you get to that critical mass where your vision becomes the one that people will swarm around and will start to take action on? Then from there, as a leader, are you willing to unlearn? One of the biggest challenges that we have around, you know, if we're talking about learning and the cognitive side, is the ability to unlearn. I've created this vision for this anticipated future. People have swarmed around it, but unfortunately we have to adapt. Complexity tells us we cannot stay the course. We must be agile. We must adapt. So in order to be able to do that, are you willing to unlearn? You know, Nick rightly pointed out that, you know, the network, that need to reach out beyond your close ties. Absolutely correct. There is a beautiful, beautiful, one of the most powerful laws that I can ever nudge somebody towards. It's Ashby's law of requisite variety that basically says that to be able to control a system, you need as much variety in the control mechanism as exists in the environment and the system itself. So therefore, if we're dealing with complex problems, the idea of the heroic leader that's going to go out there and make this decision, do it on their own, it's rubbish. And I think Nick rightly pointed out that, you know, it's a very traditional approach. Actually, we want to swarm that notion of you know, political, economic, social, technological, environmental, legal, demographic experts around us that creates the bigger picture, that heightens our awareness of what's going on, that allows us to make better decisions, but in with constructive conflict, that we want opposing positions, we want constructive conflict in this. And sorry, I feel like I'm going on a bit, and I'm possibly going off on a tangent, so I'm going to throw it back over to Nick.
Yeah, that law, the Ashby Ross law of requisite variety, very influential in my work. And again, trying to bridge the the intellect model with the action is really interesting, because as you said, it's basically if your organization, small or large, is made up of very similar types of people with kind of similar backgrounds and kind of similar awarenesses of the world, you're not going to have the level of creative variety that your market has. And actually, this was actually the reason I set my first business up 22 years ago, is because I read a very influential sort of extended blog, digital blog, HTML blog that became a book called The Clue Train Manifesto. And one of its summaries was the market's getting smarter faster than most companies. And that's kind of another way of saying it. So super simple hack is make sure either you're bringing diverse people, and that means cognitive, not just ethnic diversity, not just cognitive and ethnic diversity into your organization. And if that's not possible, or not, you haven't got the size or the money or whatever, bring that diversity into you, into whatever you're doing. And that includes, you know, listening to your kids and talking to the random person you met on the street in lockdown. These are all sources of variety that most leaders discount because they don't have time and they don't have the whatever, and you're so busy and busy and busy. So a super simple hack is go on LinkedIn today after you listen to this, pick some random person that you vaguely know, or a new person, but and make sure there's some kind of intuitive vibe inside your body. There's a bit of embodied awareness there. They're just like, if it's like a, don't know about them, but that could be a pattern of avoidance or something to think about. Just ping them up. Say, do you fancy around, you know, a half an hour call, a bit like Tyler did with this podcast, right? So it's kind of weak ties. But I want to bring something just echoing off you, David, as well. There's a, I taught for a while at a kind of systemic leadership school in Denmark that some people would be aware of called the Chaos Pilots, which are all about how to teach young people how to lead in chaos and complexity. And one of the wonderful metaphors they've got, that again, it's one of those simple meaning systems that can really help nourish people in these strange times, is you've got to build the plane as you're flying it. Which is terrifying, because obviously you want to keep everyone safe in the plane. But if you wait to finish the plane, it's too late. The world's moved on. You've got a perfect, you know, 737 max, but no one wants to fly in it. And so you've got to work out, how do you build this plane, doing the foresight work, doing the innovation work, doing the transformation work, which I should add, as my specialist subject, is often discounted in exchange for the right now improvement work, the continuous improvement, the small changes, the solve this right now stuff, whilst also, you know, steering the ship. And that's this, and that's for me, this constant, and it is, it's not, it can be a battle, but it should be a higher level resolution within you, that all of us need to spend some time doing what we do better, and making what we do better, and little changes, and getting someone to move something around and shift how they talk. And I'm going to change how I do my meeting, Friday meetings, whatever, that stuff. And we have to give ourselves time. And I start with saying to people, half an hour a week. You know, everyone can put half an hour aside. If Barack Obama can be, you know, back at home for dinner with his kids at 6 p.m. when he was president, then we all could all do half an hour a week. Where you ring fence it for some of that reflection time, connection with future stuff, whatever you need to do to make sure that you're not doing the same thing better, but it's the wrong thing for the future that's rushing towards you.
I really like that analogy of building the plane while you fly. I think a lot of people, a lot of leaders, especially over the past year, have been in that mindset, you know, but they weren't really prepared for it, right? They haven't built the skill sets to do something like that.
Not just that, they don't know it's actually okay.
That's true too, yeah.
That's just what it is that we have to do. Mm-hmm. And the old model of perfecting the product, perfecting yourself as a manager, going to do an MBA, doing perfecting, it just doesn't quite work in a post-industrial reality. Mm-hmm.
David, any follow-up thoughts on this?
Yeah, so... I'm very much about personalized approaches, I guess. I struggle to buy into the notion as, and forgive me, Nick, it's, I think that we come from very similar positions, maybe just different approaches at times, in terms of, you know, the take half an hour. Yeah, you know, I've been involved in companies that are running things called the Energy Project, for example. So it's, you must take 15 minutes, you must take half an hour, you must go do this. Well, it's only works if it's seen as meaningful to the person that you're telling them to do this. Okay, that sitting in reflection might have worked for Barack Obama, okay, for half an hour per day. For lots of other people, that doesn't necessarily work. And I don't believe it's about, you know, as Nick has said, it's not about prescriptions. It's about suggesting that there are ideas out there, because if it worked, we'd all be reading the Get Rich by Google books, and we'd all be reading them, and we'd be super billionaires, and you know, we'd all be hugely, you know, depending on your definition of success, we'd all be hugely successful. There are too many variables that come together that determine the value of this half an hour as an example. And my suggestion is, and where I really do agree with Nick, it's about becoming more aware of yourself. And I hopefully have become better. I'd like to think we get better at that as we get a bit older. if there is some wisdom to take away, it seems to be that that is true. The older we get, we do seem to develop better wisdom. But it's becoming more aware of yourself, becoming more aware of the opportunities, the unrealized opportunities, building the bigger picture. How do other people see you? What is this you? You know, building that big picture, awareness of yourself, that's valuable. But it doesn't necessarily mean having to take the half an hour. That, you know, that half an hour, you know, connecting with people on LinkedIn, and something that I do is I'll connect with people and I'll ask them their view of me. You know, who do you think I am? What do you think I do? You know, somebody gave me a view that yesterday that you end up going, really? I've never seen that in myself, you know, but that's obvious as an outsider who's been looking in on my work for the last 3 years. They came at it and I was like, I really didn't see that about myself. Mm-hmm. And now it makes you go back and reflect, and how am I giving off that impression? And it was actually that I do a lot of work in HR. And I was like, really? You know, but you know, those type of adventures, having, you know, that curiosity, you know, that's the interesting thing.
You said, because one thing definitely chime is that most people don't spend enough time thinking about evolving their narrative, their self-narrative, not just for yourself, but joining the dots for others. So often I'll work with a room full of 50 people and say, how many of you rewrite your LinkedIn profile, you know, every year or every couple of years? Almost nobody. And one of the things I know about myself is I'm evolving at pace. Like, I am a different person than I was 3 months ago, a different person from a year ago. And my own narrative and my own experiences mixed with, you know, credentials, mixed with emotional stuff, wisdom, whatever, is changing so quickly that if I don't do the work to join the dots for other people and update my bio and update my blah, blah, whatever, you know, my Instagram two sentence bits and bob, then how can I expect anyone to do that work for me? You know, how can I expect them to do the labor of trying to work out who I am when I, you know, how can it, as the said, how can anyone know me if I don't even know myself? And that's really important as a leader, because people are giving signals all the time of your narrative. And often they're not the ones that you thought you were giving. And you've also got this old stuff like, oh, he works in retail, or oh, he does a lot of whatever. And you gave that up 10 years ago, but people still think that's who you are. But I actually think, David, we're in furious agreement in that one can give intervention ideas. One can give recipes that have worked, you know, take half an hour, ask a question of your people on LinkedIn. What do you think of me? Who am I to you? These are all kind of recipes, right? Or fragments of recipe. But ultimately, if you don't have to do reflection for the next 2 months because you are full focus on just delivering something and you are really clear on it and you have congruence in your being and you are not overwhelmed and you're not, you know, you're pretty sure you're not doing the wrong thing brilliantly, then don't do that. You know, why would you do something just because some leadership guy stood up and said, do it every week? And I think that's the balance. Give people that easy. And this is what you said, actually, Tyler, about the beginning, intelligence, right? Intelligence is not mindlessly applying someone else's recipe to expect it to make a delicious meal for you in your unique context, industry, moment, whatever. Yes, we all need recipes to get to be good at cooking, to, you know, to stretch the analogy. It's good to get someone else's views what some weird Middle Eastern ingredient can do and how to push it. But ultimately, creative leadership, change leadership, transformation leadership comes when we internalize enough wisdom and intelligence of the recipes, the ingredients, and we can bake a cake, the cake that's calling for us to bake right now. And it might not be anyone else in the world would bake that cake, but that's okay because no one else is in your job. And that's a definite thing we know. No one else is in you or your job.
And I think that's absolutely brilliant because you, with no rehearsal, I actually speak a lot about the difference between leadership cook and the leadership chef. The idea that the leadership cook will take all the recipes, they'll read the books, they'll take the recipes and they will try and apply it. But they don't know if there is an ingredient missing. They don't know if there's a gap in the method. So then when it doesn't work, it's the recipe's fault. It's not my fault. Leadership chef will take a lot of the ingredients from a lot of different places and create something that is a three Michelin star meal that nobody else could have created because they have developed their understanding, their knowledge, skills, understanding, awareness to the point where they understand the ingredients and they understand the methods and how to bring them together.
And in your analogy, the moment where a chef, because I actually had this recently myself as a chef, literally, you know, literally moving from cook to chef, I guess, in lockdown, in that domain, trusting your intuition, which is not a rational, always a rational thing to go, you know what, I'm just going to put this thing in it. Don't know why I'm doing it exactly. I don't want to have to even justify it to myself in a whole justification statement in my mind. I'm just going to go with that flair. And oh my God, this is like a new thing no one's ever cooked before. How awesome is that? And I think you can bring that analogy of the cook and the chef, or I use a lot, the soldier and the warrior, this distinction between sort of operating and leading, I guess, managing, leading, it's all the same distinction, right? It's an underlying distinction. And I think it's extremely powerful, but it is a lifetime's practice. That's the bit that I think we both agree on, is you're going to get to be a chef if you're willing to put in the 10,000 plus the 200,000 after the 10,000 hours. To do it well. I think leadership is something like that. It's something to really, I'm not even prescribing this. If you want to really enjoy your leadership work and let it enjoy you and mature you and evolve you, then give it your whole being, because it is a whole being's worth, a whole life's worth of energy. And I don't mean not being a great parent and cooking either, but you know, leadership is a rich concept to devote a life to.
It is a work in progress.
Yeah. I really like the as you were talking about the chef versus the cook too. It's that that point of like permission too, where you said I don't know why I'm going to put this thing in here, but I'm allowing myself to do it. Like you said, the trust, and I have permission to do it. I think there's a lot of opportunities, especially in the corporate leadership space, to give people permission to become chefs, you know, and see what happens.
And sometimes use frozen fries too.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can't use some of those little tips and hacks to get what you need to get done and be a chef in the same moment.
Well, I want to wrap up here. We're coming on time limit and just give you both just, you know, kind of a couple minutes, just a minute or two to just summarize kind of your insights from this conversation or dialogue. I'd love to start with David.
You caught me on the hop. I was thinking in one direction and we're wrapping up and I'm going in a different direction.
Well, if you want to add a little bit of both.
No, that's the danger of these things. I'm listening to what's being said and you know, my mind is spinning and then you're going, okay, now wrap up. Okay, hold on.
And finish.
No, I can't stop my brain like that. Hold on a second. I think this has been, I really appreciate some of the things that Nick has brought to the conversation today. And it is finding that blend between the high level concepts and the practical application. And there are lessons here for us as leaders and as people who help develop leaders and really try to create positive impact in organizations, whether, you know, and by that, I mean the practical interventions. And for me, that means finding that balance, that we have that expertise and knowledge, which is why you bring us in the first place. That's why you engage with people like us. All right. But you've got I was asking yesterday in the webinar, are you curious enough to understand the science? Because for me, the science is the candle in the darkness. It gives us something to hold, you know, hang our hat on. It gives us the foundations to go forward with confidence. Actually, the science reduces the uncertainty for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you've got to be willing to embrace it, to be curious about it, and not see it as academic, this thing that's removed, you know, from what we do in organizations. Actually, it's the foundation stone of everything we do. Mm. You know, where we get in trouble is not understanding that. So I think there's some lovely takeaways in terms of understanding the academic side, if you want, the theory, the real science behind this, and then being able to take it and say, actually, we can craft some really interesting practical interventions from this that can help me today. All right. Yeah. And for me, it is about moving from curiosity to from judgment to curiosity. It's very much about understanding meaning and help leaders really looking towards creating meaningful value for people. All right. Great. And that's the interesting part for me. And that's where that notion of embodied wisdom. I think that there's a lot to be said for investigating that area, but I agree with what Nick was saying. That becomes almost a lifetime's work in itself. And so you've got to be it's got to be something that it speaks to you, that drive to go and do it. It gives you that feeling of your needs being met by engaging in that area. But once you get it, oh my gosh, go with it, exploit it, enjoy it, thrive in it. That's my message.
Thanks, David. Nick?
Yeah, just to pick on that, I mean, that sense of mastery of something, as ineffable and fuzzy as leadership, is one of the great joys. And when I say mastery, I don't mean brilliance and excellence and perfection, because literally no such thing in this field. It doesn't exist, it cannot exist. But the sense that you are in the moment of your leadership at the edges of your capacity, whatever that means for you, pushing yourself on your boundaries, going into things you usually avoid, pulling out of things you usually stamp all over, whatever it is for you, that is such an enlivening experience. And it does spread out to your loved ones, and it does spread out to the system as a whole. I would pick up on this idea of, definitely for me, it's about blending science and wisdom. I was a scientist. I think David, you were as well. I was a medic, and it is a candle in the dark. And I'll also add that inner wisdom. And I mean that from the traditions that study contemplative science. So meditation, spiritual paths of different types. There's also a candle in the dark with the timeless wisdoms that we all have as our birthright. If you read the Tao Te Ching, you're going to find some of this timeless wisdom. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, whatever you pick up. And I believe my work is about bringing that scientific edge. And as someone I wrote in the blog yesterday, copied it from a friend of mine, everyone can have their own opinion, but you can't have your own facts. And that's a really good thing to remember, right, about science, is it allows opinions, but it doesn't allow facts to be disputed to some degree. I'm also a postmodern critique of science, scientists, but that's another whole conversation. But there's also this wisdom that you get from, you know, if you do spend time meditating, you probably will have some thoughts a bit like this. And bring them together is really interesting. And that's why I think we've come, this sort of theme of today is what the Buddha called the middle way, what I would call the resolution of seeming opposites. That is it all that practical intervention, or is it all about understanding the depth of who you are as a human being in the world? Both and, not either or. And there's one of these I'm going to leave you with, which I think sums it up for me. And it actually turns back to something that you said about brilliant leaders going off into a room and going, here's our purpose, or here's our strategy, or whatever, is what actually the brain and the body do, which is, I call it middle out thinking. The brain takes in predictions from the upper brain, the cortex, the seat of intellect, if you like. And it integrates it with information coming up the vagus nerve from the gut, from the microbiome, potentially. So the bacteria in your gut, as well as your actual gut, your personal gut. And it makes sense of it all. And it makes a decision point in that moment. So it's taking prediction, and it's taking upward grassroots insight information, and it makes sense of it all. And I think that's something as a leader, if you can hold that, which is, you're brilliant. That's why you're paid the big bucks, probably. So yeah, have your away days, have your strategy things, your purpose conversations, whatever. But never doubt that people at the very hierarchically lowest in your organization can feed in amazing coalface insights and ideas about customers who they speak to every day on the phones or they're in front of every day in store. And your job should be to bring some of that grassrootsness into everyday thinking and make choices that blend intellect ultimately with sort of everyday smarts, you know, street smarts from the people who probably do most of the work in your company.
Great, thanks, Nick. And as a final question, what I like to ask the guests is, what is one word you would like to leave for leaders, leadership, or for leaders to be more intelligent about the future? Just one word that comes to mind for you and David.
Curiosity.
Nick?
I'm going to go with both slash and. So I've put as one word because we've put the slash in there. Right. Both and.
Great. Well, David and Nick, thank you both for your insights, your time, your wisdom today. I really appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.